Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. He's a Russian history scholar and plays a mean guitar. Now Dr. Brian Levin-Stankiewicz can add college president to that list. Levin-Stankiewicz took the helm of Westminster College a few weeks ago, becoming the institution's 17th president. And today on the program, he joins us to talk about his motivations and his vision. And Dr. Levin-Stankiewicz, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure to be here, Jennifer.
Dr. Brian Levin-Stankiewicz is the 17th president of Westminster College here in Salt Lake City. Before accepting the post, he served as chancellor and as a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He also served as interim provost and vice president at Eastern Washington University. We'll talk with him in a moment. Later on in the program, the Tour of Utah has been renamed America's Toughest Stage Race. It kicks off today. We'll get a primer on that. But first, the future of Westminster College. If you're a student, if you're faculty or an alum, now's your chance to speak with your new president. What would you like to see stay the same or change or improve at Utah's Liberal Arts College? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Brian Levin-Stankiewicz, welcome to Utah. You've been on the job for a few weeks now, about a month.
Yep.
How have you been spending the past few weeks?
Well, we're just trying to get to know not only all the people that are at the college, but also people in the community, get our bearings, although it's grid systems relatively easy to find one's way, and take advantage of some of the summertime activities and benefits of living in Salt Lake and the Intermountain West.
As I mentioned, before coming to Westminster, you were chancellor at a large public institution, the University of Wisconsin at Eau Claire. Why come to Westminster College, a small liberal arts college here in the West?
Sure. It's a good question. I spent, of course, my youth in both parochial schools, a Jesuit high school, and then a small liberal arts college in upstate New York at Hamilton College. And I think my career has been a progression of institutions from larger to smaller to smaller, perhaps a bit of a homing mechanism in my psyche here in terms of looking for the same kind of experience that I had as a student. And at the last institutions I served, we were fortunate to be at institutions that had very different missions and purposes, and I think we performed those missions with excellence. But I've always emulated many of the programs and philosophies prevalent among a group of colleges in the United States known as the New American Colleges and Universities. And early in this century, Westminster became one of that small group of colleges, fundamentally based on the Boyer principles of expanding scholarship to include not only research and publication, but also active scholarship, engagement with the community, active learning. And these institutions, and Westminster in particular, has taken a real lead nationally and internationally in implementing active learning in the classroom and engaging not only the students but the faculty and the entire college in the life of its immediate community, exercising a real stewardship of place. So the opportunity to come, first of all, to one of those institutions, secondly to Westminster in particular, and thirdly to return to the Intermountain West, was an opportunity that I pursued aggressively, and I'm very happy to have been given that opportunity.
You grew up in Buffalo, New York.
Mm-hmm.
I understand you were the first person in your family to go to college. How did you come to embrace higher education? Was there a moment when you realized college, mm-hmm, and a college degree open doors?
I think it was inherent in our family life. My parents always led my sister and I to expect that we would go to college, that we would graduate from college. My dad was a machinist his entire life. He's a very bright man, but didn't have the opportunities early in his youth to go on for higher education. And so I know he wanted that for his children, as did my mother, who also, again, very bright, did very well in high school, but didn't have the opportunity to go on. So it was really never a question in my mind that we'd go on for higher education. My sister actually just finished her degree at 55 years of age. She went to work, got married, had the unfortunate loss of her husband very early, and continued to raise her children, and then went back to a program very much like some of the programs we have at Westminster that requires very low residency. One can complete the program part-time on campus, part-time online, and that enabled her to complete her degree now just a couple of years ago.
Hmm. You studied Russian history, 19th century Russian history. What was the appeal there?
I think it was a bit of interest in our family roots. We come from a Slavic background. My grandfather was Belarusian, and the rest of the family primarily Polish. I grew up in a Polish-speaking neighborhood when I was a kid. Very interested my entire life in international affairs. And when I got to college, in studying various areas of history and languages, encountered an extraordinary young professor who became a mentor to me, and in fact will be speaking here with the Utah Council on Citizen Diplomacy in October. He went on to serve as a chief foreign policy advisor to Joe Biden, and therefore as the chief staffer in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So I began to take every course that Michael taught, and did my undergraduate research with him, and then went on to graduate school, largely because he really excited me about discipline, and he really lived, ate, and breathed Russian history, and kind of conveyed that to many of his students. So had that opportunity in graduate school. I had the opportunity to live in the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union back in the 70s on a Fulbright-Hayes scholarship where I was doing research for my dissertation. Really a life-changing opportunity as well.
And you considered a career as a foreign diplomat. I mean, what drew you back into academia? Was it this idea that mentorship matters, that, you know, it played a huge role in your own career?
It did, and some of it was just opportunity. And when Debbie and I met and then were married, we decided we were already in our late 20s at that point, and decided that we really did want to start a family and settle down. So the various opportunities available for a career were either itinerant or sedentary, and the opportunity to start a family was more facile in working at the university. And we had twin boys shortly after that. They're 29 now, and doing quite well. We're very proud of them. But then, of course, within the academic world, opportunities come up. If you do your job well, people want you to do another job, and then another job, and then another job. And that's led me into administration and down the path of becoming a university president.
I read in a magazine profile of you that you compared the skill set of a foreign diplomat to the ones needed as a college administrator. Explain what you see as the similarities between international diplomacy and management of a college, a university.
Well, those of us who lead universities work with a variety of constituencies. Members of our board, for example, come from the business world, come from the nonprofit world. They're entrepreneurs, they're executives. Our faculty come from a different perspective that's dedicated really to their disciplines, to the pursuit of knowledge, to the education of their students. And we often find it necessary to translate and actually use very different language in working with each of those constituencies. So talking about being innovative and entrepreneurial to a group of business executives means something very different when you're talking to a group of faculty. And our job is to really translate that and explain to the one group how we are being innovative and entrepreneurial, and on the other hand, to take a look at the external environment that's our job to deal with as university leadership, and make sure that our institutions are healthy and competitive and continue to serve the missions that we set for ourselves. And that oftentimes requires having a foot on in multiple worlds.
Speaking with Dr. Brian Levin-Stankiewicz, he is the new president of Westminster College here in Salt Lake City. And if you'd like to join our conversation, do you have questions about the future, the vision of this man, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and Henry's joining us from Salt Lake City. Henry, hi.
Hello. Common question ties in perfectly with this discussion because I come from my education, undergrad education was a liberal arts education, and I know the benefits of it, but I'm wondering if the president could remind the community why the reasoning skills of a liberal arts education really are wonderful skills for the current economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Henry. So there has been a local debate and nationally about the usefulness of a liberal arts education. There's been a lot of funding and emphasis placed on math and science and technology. Where does the liberal arts education fit in today's world?
Well, unfortunately, in today's world, we take terms and often politicize them. And so liberal education at a very pedestrian level has unfortunately been tainted in some people's minds by the word liberal. And in fact, it comes from old study of seven basic subjects. But we're in a very changing environment right now, and we've got a lot of online learning going on, a lot of free courses, for example. The assumption that I read once was that everyone can teach themselves whatever they want to learn now because the information is available. I would take issue with that. There are very few Steve Jobs in the world who could perhaps teach themselves, and that's a rare individual. And we do need people to facilitate our learning. My feeling is that the liberal arts education, which provides both breadth and depth within a discipline, trains the mind to teach oneself whatever one wants after receiving that education. So it's a wonderful foundation to go on to a life that will include many changes in careers, will include the expectation that we continuously learn, oftentimes on our own. And I just the other day read a very interesting statement that many fundamentalist and totalitarian societies have achieved excellence in technology and science and engineering. But very few of them have achieved excellence in the arts and in tolerance and in the kinds of soft skills that businesses value that are essential to communication and that are really the cannot be avoided in studying what has been traditionally called the liberal arts, social sciences, cognitive sciences, the arts, literature, and communication.
Henry, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. We're speaking with Brian Levin-Stankiewicz. He's the new president of Westminster College. And if you'd like to join us to talk about the challenges, the opportunities facing higher ed generally and Westminster College in particular, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're meeting the new president of Westminster College, Dr. Brian Levin-Stankiewicz, and talking about his vision for the future of the institution and higher education issues in general. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. What do you get from Westminster? What would you like to see emphasized or changed or improved if you're a student or a faculty member or an alum? give us a call. 801-355-TALK is that number, 801-355-8255. Dr. Levin Stankiewicz, I want to talk about some of the achievements during your tenure at UW-Eau Claire. You pushed for and got approved $110 million worth of new buildings on the campus, a new student center, a new academic center, upgrades to various facilities. Is expansion and renovation part of your vision for Westminster College's future?
Well, these are, you set your goals based on the environment and the institution that you're serving and its mission. When I went to Eau Claire in 2006, the campus had not had significant construction or renovation in many decades. The last building built on campus had been already 30-some years old. And the quality of instruction was not matched by the quality of the facilities that we were using. In addition to which, pedagogy has changed considerably, and we need different kinds of facilities in order to teach students today. So I really found that I needed to set an agenda of reconstructing many of our facilities and gaining some new ones. And it wasn't an agenda I went to Eau Claire with, but when I got there, found that that's really what we needed. And so each, you know, this fall we'll go through a strategic planning update, if you will. My predecessor, Michael Bassus, and his leadership team had led a strategic planning process that was nearly 10 years ago. So it's time to revisit that, take stock of where Westminster has come over the last 10 years, the innovations that we've achieved, what's working well, what's in need of continued attention, and to engage the campus community in defining our goals for the next 10 years.
Hmm. Getting this chunk of money, $110 million mm-hmm. for buildings, mm-hmm. Could not have been easy in Wisconsin. It's no secret that mm-hmm. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker has taken on public employees' right to collectively bargain. He killed legislation for faculty members at UW to unionize. Mm-hmm. How did you navigate that kind of, I don't know, could it be fairly characterized as a hostile environment to education?
Well, on one level, that's how it's been characterized. My philosophy has always been that whether it be members of political parties, various constituents within the community, all fundamentally agree that we need to have an educated workforce, that we need to educate our children. And there's a common ground that I have always been able to find with leadership in any community I've been in. And we did that in Wisconsin. Yes, there's certain political lobbying that you need to do in a state system to obtain funds. But we had a lot of support primarily from our own community, from the chamber in our community, the Economic Development Council, our alumni across the state who were able to connect with their legislators. And so some of that money was legislative. Some of it was privately raised as we renovated some sports facilities, for example, that we shared with the city of Eau Claire and went in together with all of the other users. Some of the construction that we began was really public-private partnership funding. And one major project that we announced just before I left Eau Claire was an arts center and student housing in the core of the downtown area, which is a project in which the university only has a small part, a sort of condominium agreement, if you will, with a developer who will also be creating multiple use space for retail, commercial, and residential space right along the shores of a beautiful river there.
Hmm. As part of your renovations, you had planned a new student center.
Yes.
And the initial plans included removing a tree that was quite significant to
yes.
Two American
yes.
Indian tribes, caused a bit of controversy.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get out of that jam?
Well, you know, I think in the end we went back to the core values of the institution and the core values of us as people. again, that was a when you're building within a state system of higher education, there are many cooks in the kitchen. And unfortunately, over the course of some planning, the building was moved and positioned over a tree that was a replacement for the original council oak tree that was, in fact, on the seal of the campus insignia. And so it had a lot of meaning historically. The story was that the council oak tree was a place of peacemaking among warring tribes, warring Indian tribes in that part of the country, and so it was very fitting that that be the place of higher learning. One might draw a parallel between warring tribes today in a very different sense and the university needing to be a place of civil dialogue, of understanding, of tolerance, and of learning. So it was very important to maintain that symbolism. As a historian, I also felt that this tree was an artifact of our past that was very important to our future. We were able to work with the state building folks and really insisted that the building be moved back to its original position so that the tree could be protected.
What did you learn from this whole incident?
Well, I learned a lot about crisis management, but it wasn't. That's not the only time I've dealt with that. I think what I learned was that we really need to communicate effectively. We need to involve key constituencies in decision making, and that we need to be respectful as a society, as a campus, as a college community. And understand the different perspectives and the values that people bring to their work and their lives.
Speaking with Dr. Brian Levin-Stankiewicz, he's the new president of Westminster College here in Salt Lake City. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about the future of this campus, as well as higher ed in general, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Well, when we talk about higher ed, it's hard to escape the reality of the high cost of higher ed. During your tenure, you proposed a tuition hike. It seems rather modest, $300 over a four-year period. Mm-hmm. But raising tuition is never a popular proposition. Can you talk generally about the cost of higher education? What can be done to make college more affordable and accessible to more students?
Let me briefly talk about the raising tuition in Wisconsin. We had an opportunity as a campus within a larger system to pursue what was called differential tuition. And this was tuition above and beyond that base tuition charged by at the Board of Regents level for all of the state institutions. We literally went to our students and made the case that the quality of their education depended on additional resources. We involved them in the planning. I asked them what they thought was a reasonable increase. They came back with a number. We then engaged in extensive discussions, including visiting students at lunchroom tables in their residence hall rooms, engaging them with alumni, conducting webinars and web interviews with their parents at home. And in the end, our students voted to increase their own tuition. And they went to the Board of Regents with us to argue on behalf of that. The students were also, it was a very radical experiment in student empowerment because the students exercise a great deal of control over how that gets spent. We hear a lot of criticism from places like the Delta Project and others nationally that talk about how even though the rising cost, the cost of higher ed has been rising, not a whole lot of that money has been spent on instruction. We were able to really target that tuition increase towards instruction and direct benefits to students. And I think in your promo you mentioned something about to fund study abroad programs. It was really to fund students availing themselves of what we call high-impact practices. Study abroad is one of them. It immerses a student in a foreign culture. It kind of takes them out of their comfort zone and forces them to grow. Others are undergraduate research, where you're working one-on-one with a faculty member. These are not low-cost, high-productivity kinds of activities, but they're activities from which every student benefits immensely. And so our goal was to make sure that every one of our students was able to participate in one or more of those activities.
Mm. But how do you reconcile that in this brave new world that, mm-hmm. of higher education? You mentioned earlier that there are a lot of online classes, a lot of free online classes. I think Stanford just announced that it's providing, hundreds more mm-hmm. online classes for free. Mm-hmm. So, how does that fit into this equation of what higher education is and what a college degree means?
Well, there's a lot of free online classes. I haven't seen a free online degree yet. The evaluation of student performance, the actual credentialing, if you will, the actual awarding of credit is something that even MIT and the Stanfords and the other online big providers, Coursera and others, haven't quite developed a business model to make workable yet. In fact, there's an article the other day questioning whether MIT is going to have a business model that works in that way. What it's done is provide a lot of content for the facilitation of learning by colleges and universities all across the country, so that we can access many of these lectures by some of the leading people in their disciplines. The same way we've accessed videos in the past, the same way we've accessed online resources as they've evolved over time. And the real challenge is that we deal with what one author calls the iron triangle. One side is access, the other side is quality, and the third side is cost. And so how do you balance access, quality, and cost? We can provide low-cost, high access without the quality. We can provide high quality, high cost without the access. And so the challenge is to really balance those three elements. And Westminster, I think, has done a wonderful job within its sector of higher education of keeping costs relatively low. Our loan indebtedness of our students is comparable to many public institutions in the country. Our student default rate is extremely low, and I think as time goes on, we're going to begin to measure quality in higher education, not so much by what are the ACT or SAT scores of incoming students, but how many of your students graduate? What is their indebtedness when they graduate? How have you helped them work through college in a way that allows them to then go out and buy that house and buy that first car when they get their first job? And have you provided an education that will not only allow them to get that first job, but that will establish them as competent and capable of transitioning throughout their lives and being good citizens and being good parents? Those are all, I think, we're going to see a changing definition of quality toward outcomes rather than simply who can attract the brightest or the wealthiest students in America.
So within this changing river, I mean, you mentioned that you're going through a strategic master planning process later this year, mm-hmm. but I mean, just generally, what is your vision for Westminster College, what it can become?
Well, first of all, I think, there's a number of levels of that. On the one hand, I think we're, as a small institution, we have an opportunity to continue to provide a very personalized, individualized instruction. And what it really makes me happy is that many of the alumni I've heard speak about their experiences in even our online courses and our low residency courses have said that a real key was that it was still a very personalized experience for them. So we have the culture of focusing on the individual student. We don't have to build that culture. What we have to do is figure out the intersection between that culture and how we can take advantage of technology and apply it in a way that doesn't lose the value that the individual gains from a Westminster educational experience. I think we also have to look at how we can continue to contribute to an educated workforce here in Utah. The state has been very successful at attracting new businesses, many of them in high-tech scientific areas, and we need to be a contributor to that as well as to the quality of life in Salt Lake and our environment here. I got the chance the first few weeks while in Salt Lake to live in one of the campus-owned buildings right near the campus in Sugar House. It's a fantastic neighborhood. It's vibrant. It's diverse. It was close to Emigration Canyon for me to do some biking, and it was just a lot of fun to be there. So contributing to our geography and our region and the development of talent and connecting with all the potential talent in this region. We have a changing human geography here. We have a changing demographic. We want to make sure that every part of our community has the opportunity to become educated, as I did as a first-generation student, and to advance their families and advance their careers as well.
So do you think the demographics of the campus culture will change? I mean, Westminster College seems to have had great success in outreaching to, you know, the kids coming right out of high school. Mm-hmm. And but what about those non-traditional students like your sister?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a potential audience for the Westminster message?
Well, it is. And I think under Dr. Bassus, we have addressed a lot of those constituencies with some of our so-called project-based bachelor's degrees, a project-based master's degree, which allows people to continue to work and complete their education, whether it be at the baccalaureate or the master's level. We just launched a master's in strategic communication that is really targeting an adult population, people working in the field of communication across the entire Intermountain West. The same thing with the new Montessori program we have in our College of Education. It's really the only Montessori training program in the Intermountain West, and again, a summer-based program that will allow people to continue to work and continue to grow intellectually and professionally.
Our time is running short. As I mentioned, though, you're an expert in 19th century Russian history, and I understand that you continued to teach a few classes here and there mm-hmm. while you were chancellor at Eau Claire. Will you do the same at Westminster College?
I hope to. Probably not the first year. It's always a first year on any new job. It's always a very busy one, learning a new community, learning a new culture, and integrating myself into that culture. But I think that, you know, teaching is the core work of what we do as a college or a university, and I think it's important that those of us who are capable of contributing to the core work continue to do so to the best of our ability. It gives me also a chance to interact with students, not as an administrator, but in the classroom, which is a very different kind of interaction. It also gives me the opportunity to remain intellectually active. I mean, you can read a lot of things in administration and higher education policy and the economy, but you know, when you can get up really early in the morning and say, okay, now I need to catch up on legal history or Russian history, and you really immerse yourself, you remember why it is you're doing this, and it kind of takes you back to your roots and gives you a different perspective on the rest of the day.
The joy of teaching without the pressure of publishing, huh?
Well, there's a little of that, too.
Dr. Brian Levin-Stankiewicz, he's the new president of Westminster College here in Salt Lake City. And, President, thanks very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Coming up next, a conversation about the new Tour of Utah, a tougher race. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City.